I'm Rear Admiral Eugene Carroll, U.S. Navy retired. I served 37 years on active duty in the United States military, in the Navy, and in that period of time as a naval aviator, I moved from operations in Korea and Vietnam to command of an aircraft carrier, a carrier task force, and duty in the Pentagon and positions of responsibility for planning both conventional and nuclear war. Upon my retirement, I moved to the Center for Defense Information, where we take a independent professional view of U.S. military programs and policies, and we serve as responsible critics of what we identify as waste and excess in our military programs.
I believe you have recently written an article about national missile defense entitled "Why Should We Care?" I'm wondering if you could tell me about what you covered in that article.
Yes, "Why Should We Care?" is the first article in a special report prepared by the Center for Defense Information entitled "National Missile Defense, What Does It All Mean?" In my introduction, "Why Should We Care?", I pointed out that the future of the U.S. military programs rides on our determination to break the ABM Treaty of 1972. The entire arms control structure, which maintains stability in nuclear terms, rests upon that treaty. All of the agreements to reduce weapons subsequently assumed that neither side was going to deploy a national missile defense system. President Putin of Russia has declared if we break that treaty, break that commitment, then they will not be bound by plans to continue the reduction of nuclear weapons in the future. So the reason we should care is that instead of ending up safer, instead of ending up in a world with fewer nuclear weapons and more stability, we're going to end up in a competitive situation in which other nations, particularly Russia and China, attempt to overcome our defense capabilities by increased offensive systems of their own. That is a very important reason to care.
In fact, you also point out that our allies, unlike where we would expect both Russia and China to oppose this, our allies are opposed to this. What do you see the significance there?
This is a very unusual development. Normally, the United States is consulting. We're working through the NATO alliance, through the security agreement with Japan, through ANZUS, to coordinate our plans and policies and to make it clear to our closest friends and allies that we're here to help them as we prepare our own defenses. We, in this case, have threatened to make the world a less stable place, a more dangerous world, and we have assumed that our friends and allies would go along with us, and this is just not the case. They see the danger, they see the costs, they see the unilateral nature of the U.S. declaring itself above the rules that we have agreed to in the past. So this is a very ominous event. We can expect our potential adversaries to object to anything we do in terms of military programs. To have our closest friends and allies objecting to national missile defense ought to tell us that we're on the wrong track if we're talking about security.
How about the fact that the administration doesn't really seem concerned about what either members of Congress, members of Senate, or even American people feel about this system? Have you seen similar situations like that in the past, or is this unique?
The single-mindedness of the people who are committed to a national missile defense program is virtually unique. It assumes that the control is in their hands and that we will do what they want us to do, which is to invest tens of billions of dollars, more than $100 billion, in creating a program for which there is no valid military requirement. This seems to stem openly and directly from the 1994 contract with America, which Newt Gingrich constructed. One of the provisions of that contract with America was there would be a national missile defense program. And ever since that date, it has become a proof of orthodoxy, a litmus test of devotion to the Republican program and to the defense of the United States as the Republican Party describes it. This is a very dangerous precedent in which a political declaration becomes an immutable policy which drives U.S. military programs that in the long term will make us less safe, more vulnerable, and certainly greatly increase the cost of our defense programs.
Based on the objectives of CDI, where I believe one of your primary goals is pushing for rational military programs, would you consider national missile defense to be a rational military program?
Yes, you've put the purpose of CDI very well. We favor a sound, effective, affordable national defense program which has coherent and rational basis. We must visualize the world and our role in it in a rational way. And the National Missile Defense Program is irrational. There is no threat today. This is agreed. This isn't an opinion of the Center for Defense Information. This is established in every intelligence study and report issued. There is no rogue nation with the capability of attacking the United States with long-range missiles. The intelligence studies looking to the future all find that such a threat, such a development, is the least likely form of threat to the United States. There are all sorts of different, easier, less expensive ways for rogue nations, for terrorist activities to go forward to threaten the United States. For example, and this is very specific, if I am the leader of this so-called rogue state and I want to detonate a crude nuclear weapon, which is all I have in the United States, the way I do it is weld it in the hull of a merchant ship and sail it into any harbor in the United States in the normal course of business, and when I want it to go off, it goes off. This is a reliable way of delivering a nuclear device that I couldn't get there ever by missile, because I don't have the missiles, and the missile wouldn't carry the weapon if I had it. I simply am lost in the illogic, the irrational insistence upon creating a defense against a non-existent threat.
What are some other programs that have greatly concerned you over the years that we're still tied to?
The first overriding, troubling, dangerous program that has been in effect in the United States for too long is reliance on nuclear weapons for a sense of security. We have led the world in the nuclear arms race since 1945. We possess the most dangerous nuclear arsenal in existence, and we seem to think that it is the cornerstone of our security. There is actually a determination called Presidential Decision Directive 60, which says nuclear weapons are the cornerstone of national security. And this, to the Center for Defense Information, is absolutely senseless. Nuclear weapons do not provide security. Nuclear weapons are the only threat to the security of the United States. The Russian nation possesses enough nuclear weapons to destroy this country 5 or 10 times over. And by the way, a national missile defense will do nothing about that. It will not protect us from the Russian missiles. For that reason, we want to see the nation turn away from relying on nuclear weapons as our security blanket. The second thing that we're very concerned about is our role as world's policemen. We're the only nation in the world which divides the entire globe up into military zones. We appoint a general or an admiral as commander-in-chief of Pacific, Atlantic, European, Central, Southern, you name it. There's a four-star with troops and fleets assigned to represent and advance U.S. interests through the military power and presence of the United States of America. We are the cop on a global beat, and this is creating increasing resistance to the United States of America because the nations of the world are growing increasingly restless about our presence and our willingness to use military power to promote our own interests. We at the center see the need for a much more cooperative approach to international security. We believe we should be working for mutual security. Instead of advancing U.S. security above that of other nations, we should be working to make the world a more cooperative and peaceful place. And I would say those two things, over-reliance on nuclear weapons and the belief that we can be on guard all around the world 365 days a year, the two things that trouble us the most.
Do you think that when you joined the Navy just several months before we detonated at Trinity and dropped the bombs on Hiroshima and Nagasaki, do you think that affected your views significantly?
That's an interesting question. Actually, I joined the Navy on the 12th of December, 1942, which was almost 3 years before Trinity. And even when Trinity went and Nagasaki and Hiroshima, I knew very little about nuclear weapons. They were something we read about in the newspaper. The secrets of nuclear weaponry were held very, very closely, and even those of us serving in the armed forces knew nothing, next to nothing about them. It wasn't until 1955 when the Navy made a nuclear weapons delivery pilot out of me, trained me to employ nuclear weapons in war, that I found out about the destructive power of these weapons, the indiscriminate destructive power, the fact that when you use them, you couldn't confine the damage to a military target. You destroyed and killed far beyond any level justified for military purposes. In 1956, I was standing watch on the deck of an aircraft carrier ready to launch in my aircraft with a nuclear weapon in 5 minutes, and that weapon, delivered on a supply depot and rail center in a major European city, would have killed 600,000 people. 600,000 people to destroy a logistics facility. You can't justify fighting that way. You cannot ever justify using that level of destructive force. And this feeling grew on me over the years in my service. I commanded squadrons with nuclear missions, commanded an aircraft carrier equipped with 100 nuclear weapons. I was director of military operations in Europe under General Haig, and I had 7,000 nuclear weapons in my custody, as it were. I was responsible for their security and readiness. You can't fight that way, and this is what we're trying to tell people here at the Center for Defense Information. They don't make us safe. They do not represent security. They are the ultimate threat to the survival of the human race on Earth, and we'd better get them under control while there's still time. This is the reason that we're so opposed to national missile defense. Instead of working for and promoting the reduction of nuclear weapons, our determination to go forward and violate the Anti-Ballistic Missile Treaty of 1972 is going to increase nuclear risks, not decrease them.
In 1972, the year that you became a Rear Admiral, it was also the year that we signed the ABM Treaty and the SALT I Treaty. Did that raise your hopes at the time that maybe we were getting out of this nuclear nightmare?
That's another interesting question. While we were serving and had our responsibilities for the readiness of our units, for the training and equipment and so on, I don't think, had the strategic overview that I have attained later in my career in CDI. These things were happening, but we tended to see the picture in small perspectives, not in large measure. It is only in the recent years, the history of nuclear programs since I retired, that I see the critical importance of those two agreements. The SALT I, which limited nuclear arms systems, launchers, and the ABM treaty, which limited competition in defensive systems, were complementary. Each one supported the other one. You couldn't have one without the other. It took the two agreements simultaneously to agree to limit nuclear arms and competition in defensive systems. And every significant arms control measure, effort to reduce nuclear arms since that date, has rested upon the foundation of those two agreements. Here we are now proposing to pull that foundation out and to take away the rules for competition and the means of verifying our forces and ensuring compliance with arms control agreements. I could not have foreseen this situation in 1972, and so I must confess that I didn't realize then how important this step was.
But seeing how important it is now, and you having served and been responsible for potentially launching these weapons against targets and people, I would have to imagine it would make you fairly angry the way our current administration is just tossing out this incredibly important treaty.
It's infuriating just to think that in support of this politically expedient concept of national missile defense, we are taking actions which are opposed not only by our potential adversaries, but by our closest friends and allies, and by the weight of the scientific community in the United States, who point out why this system can never be made to work as a system. We just had the test the other day of one interceptor against one mock warhead, and they got a collision. They hit a bullet with a bullet over the Pacific Ocean, and they are trumpeting the fact that this means the system will work. There was an op-ed in the Washington Post yesterday that said, the system works. We are going to get away from mutual assured destruction, and our children will be spared the future dangers of nuclear war. Of all of the demagogic, irrational conclusions from one simple test, this takes the cake, and it represents ammunition for those who say, oh yes, we're on the right track with national missile defense. I've written, I've spoken, I've contacted the president, the Congress, my representatives and senators, to no discernible effect. Politically, they think they're on the right track, and they're going to ride this horse called NMD for every benefit that they see in it. It is troublesome to think that facts are thrown away and ignored in the interests of politics.
So how do you see potentially stopping this runaway train?
Yeah, this is a critical question. Can the democratic process work? Can the fact that, if properly informed and concerned, the American public can turn its own administration, its own government around? I am very troubled by the weakness of this process right now. The heavy weapons all seem to be in the hands of the establishment, of the group that wants to go forward with this. And they put things out in the media about how well we're doing and how this means we're proving the capabilities of the National Missile Defense, and getting the public to respond and say, no, this is the wrong way to go, is a challenge that all of us are trying to meet. One thing that will help, and I've been trying to work on this also, is the voices of our allies. If your closest friends and allies are telling you you're doing the wrong thing, you have to pay attention. And I'm hoping President Bush will get an earful and a headful of criticism in Europe this week as he confers with the European allies and with Mr. Putin. There is a way that pressure can be applied. It isn't part of a democratic process, but it's part of the security process that I hope he can be made to recognize and appreciate.
Yeah, I agree with what you're saying there, but I must admit I find it kind of sad when I'm actually rooting for the Russians and, let's say, the European countries to put up resistance, when in fact it's really the American people that should be resisting this and taking charge of their country.
Absolutely. Democracy rests upon the will of the concerned and informed citizens, the majority. If they are neither informed nor concerned, it's going to fail. The democratic process will not work, and we will be at the mercy of those who see gain, see profit in proceeding with a program which makes us less secure, increases the risk in the future of nuclear competition and conflict.
I'm talking to you from Seattle, which is 20 miles away from the Bangor Trident nuclear submarine base. I'm wondering if you could just briefly tell Seattleites why they should be concerned about having a sub-base 20 miles away.
The fact is that when we move from the Poseidon system to the Trident system, we move to missiles that carried very accurate, much more powerful weapons than Poseidon. Poseidon can only be used to retaliate for an attack on the United States. It was a force to be held in reserve and used to punish an aggressor. The Trident system has the capability to initiate a war, to go after the offensive forces of an adversary such as Russia, and hopefully to destroy the weight of their nuclear forces. This is called first strike or preemptive warfare. When you couple that with talk about some sort of a defensive system, a national missile defense system, you frighten the others. You convince them, or at least make them fearful, that you are actually planning such a strategy, that you want to be able to attack first and then ride out what remains of the retaliation. In that sense, if the Russians feel they must conduct a preemptive strike of their own, that they must initiate the war because we're about to, Bangor is going to be one high priority target. Any place that we have nuclear forces of the capability of our Trident submarines will be the top of the target list. And certainly Bangor will have, and does have, at this instant, weapons in the Russian silos that will be fired against Bangor in the absolute opening moments of a nuclear attack.
I don't want to keep you for too much longer. I just wanted to give you a chance to talk about anything else that you think is critical or hasn't been getting attention over the years.
Let me talk a little bit about money. We've been talking about the dangers of excessive reliance on nuclear weapons and military forces. But there is another aspect to this that is extremely troublesome, and this is the growing expenditures for the military programs. I was just looking today at the planned budget 5 years ago, and it was expected that in the year 2002, the plan called for $290 billion to go to the military. Right now, the program that is on the Hill, up before the Congress, calls for something like $334 billion. That's, what, $44 billion more than we were thinking about just 5 years ago. And by the way, the plan 5 years ago included expected inflation. This is an increase in the planned level of expenditure. The money going into these military systems is taken away from all of the other competing needs within our society and economy. You can't do improved education if you're spending tens of billions of dollars more on the military. You can't improve our highways. You can't improve our medical care. You can't solve the energy problem with alternative energy systems. Every dollar that goes into military programs has an opportunity cost in terms of something we don't do elsewhere to strengthen the society and economy here at home. And I think we've got to start weighing what these things like national missile defense, which are totally irrelevant to our security. Well, they're worse than irrelevant. They're detrimental to our security. And start thinking in terms of what we could do that will improve the quality of life and the security of our nation in the future. Dollars do count. We must start keeping score of the money that is going into this bottomless pit we call national defense. Here at the Center for Defense Information, we're completing a study. We've been working on it now for almost a year, in which we will describe an effective, affordable military program and military forces which will leave the United States as the number one power in the world. We're not going to be defenseless. We're not beating our swords into plowshares. We're maintaining the defense capability that we must have in the world today, but we're going to be able to do this at much lower cost in order to free up money for other vital national needs. And we think when we publish this report that we will try to get attention for it, we'll try to get members of Congress and the public to understand it and accept it, and that we can have a voice in shaping the security of the United States in the 21st century. The way it's going now is we're trying to be the policeman on the beat all around the world at the same time we develop new military capabilities, not only on Earth but in space, and continue this confrontational approach globally. It's time to start thinking in terms of a cooperative world order instead of a confrontational world order, which we dominate as the world superpower.